Dear listener, before we start today's episode, I want to tell you about a resource I've created, which I want to share with you for free. I'll tell you what it is and how to get it. If you're not already writing tests for your Rails code, you're probably aware that testing can help you ship your work faster and with fewer defects. Because testing is such an in-demand skill, but since so few developers know how to do it properly, I've created a resource for you called The Beginner's Guide to Rails Testing. This guide is a short, downloadable book which answers the most common Rails testing questions that beginners tend to have, including, which testing framework should I use, RSpec or Minitest? What level of test coverage should I shoot for? What are the different kinds of Rails tests? What are all the Rails testing tools, and how do I use them? My guide covers these questions and several others. To get the Beginner's Guide to Rails Testing, go to railstestingguide.com. Now on to the episode. Today I'm here with Matthew Bellantoni. Matthew, welcome to the show.
Thanks, Jason. It's a pleasure to be here.
Glad to have you here. Would you like to tell us about yourself?
Yeah, sure. I can give you just a quick rundown about that. So I've worked at venture-backed companies for about the last 25 years or so. A lot of those Rails-oriented, all software. I kind of talk about those in three chapters these days, or three sort of phases. First phase, hands-on coder working in the electronic design automation industry, which is actually people building software for people to build chips. So like super hard problems, super interesting, really cutting edge. Kind of one of the few times in my career where I knew algorithmic things that like 100 people in the world knew. Super exciting, but a lousy business. From there, I kind of transitioned into more traditional enterprise software, and really where I first started to encounter the web and where I started to learn Rails, really. So did that for a bit, did a bunch of interesting things there, at least interesting to me. Spent some time as a technical marketing person, did hands-on coding, was kind of a manager for a bit. Did a bunch of things, just learned a lot. But at the end of that, started to find my way back into engineering leadership. And that kind of brings me to the third sort of phase, where I've been generally the most senior technical person. So running engineering organizations of like 1 to 75 people, companies that were pre-revenue to up to $100 million of revenue, valued between like $1 million and $1 billion. So, and so that's sort of what I've been doing now these days. I work on what I call mostly non-venture scale projects. So I have a jobs board, Rails gigs, which is how we got connected, which is a Rails job board. And I also, my real day job is what I call fractional CTO, which is where I come into organizations that are kind of in that sweet spot where my executive history has been. And I kind of help coach up teams, help them identify problems and work through problems for, like, you know, example, you're a company who just raised an A round, but the CTO has never really been a manager, is really just a coder, you know, maybe hasn't even, like this is maybe even their first kind of real software job. I help them figure out what they don't know and problems that they do know and help them kind of chart a course to being successful.
Yeah, it's really interesting, the CTO role, because it can be such a range of the kind of person who can fill it. Like, I could imagine myself being qualified to be a CTO of a very small startup, but a larger organization, I could maybe just barely be qualified to even work there at all as a developer, you know? And yeah, I've worked with...
Yeah, go ahead. Like, there's no definitions for these jobs. You know, I think, you know, people are like, what's a VPE? What's a CTO? You know, what does a CTO do exactly? And, you know, the answer is like, it depends. You know, sometimes CTOs run organizations. Sometimes CTOs are, you know, the first co-founder who was technical, and they don't actually have a staff, and you know, they just want to noodle around. But you know, some people do actually want to, you know, figure out how to build a large organization and like learn how to budget and learn how to do a hiring plan, learn how to build like, and this is one of the things that I'm actually really interested in, like repeatable, efficient hiring processes, like especially, you know, venture-backed companies, you know, they get an A round, they get a B round, and the marching orders are to go like double the size of an organization. And like, there's a lot of ways to screw that up. And, you know, if you were the person, what you like is hacking on a Rails app or, you know, hacking on whatever. And that's really, you know, you're really attached to like solving customer problems through code. You know, once things start to scale, like, that can easily not be your day job anymore.
Yeah. Yeah. My job has taken an interesting transition. When I started, it was all coding. And I was working on a brand new app, and it was like a dream situation because I didn't have to deal with anybody else's baggage or anything. It was all just my own clean, fresh code. And then we started actually using the application, and things got a little more real, and you had to deal with the reality of real software that people use and interruptions and stuff like that. And now it's not just me. There's one other developer working with me. And so a lot of my time is spent teeing things up for him and like reviewing his work and stuff like that. And then the business is even bigger now, and so there's more interruptions and all that kind of stuff. And I was doing some coding yesterday, and I realized, like, man, I kind of like have forgotten how to code. It takes just a really small amount of time to just like forget how to do it. It's not like I forgot the things that I knew. It's like that muscle hadn't been exercised in a long time. So it was like, wait a second.
Oh, yeah.
Okay, I run the test, then I like change some code, then I run the test. Okay, yeah, that's how it goes. All right, got it. It took me a while to get back into it.
Yeah, I've always considered myself very technical and have prided myself through my entire career, even when I was leading large organizations, to say, like, I've coded in the last 24 hours. I like to say that, and I like to make sure that that's true. And it mostly is true. But, you know, there was a period about 10 years ago, probably more than 10, time flies, that I sat down to start one of these companies that I've bootstrapped in the past. And I still consider myself highly technical, but it was the first time that I had sat down to kind of write code full time. And I was just like shocked at how much my skills had degraded. So this was in Rails, and I've used Rails since 2007. I've been an enthusiast, and I've always got, you know, if you look at my development directory on my Mac, there's like 1,000 unfinished projects. I'm like always starting something.
Story
but I was
life.
Just really, really shocked at like how far my skills had degraded, and being aware that, like, oh man, this thing that I just took a day to do should have taken me, you know, an hour or two. And then through that process, I actually got those chops back. And I've actually worked harder at coding since then, because I'm really reluctant, probably to my detriment, to give that up. And partially because I still keep learning things, and I still keep discovering things. And you know, I love Ruby, I love Rails. And part of it's just, I think, you know, recognizing patterns in code. And I know that a few weeks ago you were talking about like fax transmissions, and like how you had like sort of thought about that model. And I really enjoy that. And then even just Rails itself is so large of a framework that I still find myself like going through the API documents and like suddenly discovering something and realizing that, oh, hey, this is actually probably the Rails way to do this thing. Like the current pattern is a thing a few years ago, which I'd never really used before, where, you know, you have like this current object for the current user, which seems like this really Railsy thing, meaning that this is probably something DHH uses all the time, but like, I never saw a screencast about it, but it appears a couple times in the documentation.
So is actually something called the current pattern?
So, yeah. So there is, in the Rails documentation, there is I forget the particulars of this. There's like some sugar that will let you keep thread-specific variables. And so this is a way for you to do things that are, you know, thread-safe in the context of a web request. And so the main implementation of this that I've seen is to create a current class that basically what happens at the beginning of the web request, you set like a user field and maybe an account field and maybe maybe not the time zone, but those kinds of things. Like it's a global variable. It's basically a global variable for the request, and it's a way to encapsulate it. And I think this is a thing that you use a lot in Rails, but I've never read a book where it was mentioned. I maybe saw, you know, a DHH webcast maybe, and it appears a couple times in the like in the documentation, like in an example for like has many or something, like how you do the default initialization of a belongs to, rather. And so like I'm still learning stuff like that in Rails, and I think I'm pretty good at it, you know, it's like I'm really reluctant to give those skills up, even though, you know, though I occasionally do actual Rails consulting, it's not really what, you know, my main focus day to day.
Yeah. So speaking of consulting, I'm really interested in this part because, okay, what you do, or what it sounds to me like what you do, is something different from what most Rails or most freelance programmers or people who call themselves consultants do. Because I've said before on the show that the vast majority of people who call themselves consultants are really just contractors, and they're not doing anything different from a regular full-time employee programmer. They're just writing code. The only difference is they're getting paid by the hour to write code instead of getting paid a salary to write code. But it sounds like you do something different. And so can you explain a little bit more, when you engage with a client, what kind of work are you doing with that client?
Yeah, so it depends on the thing. So, you know, I do some Rails consulting, which I think is often, you know, probably more akin to contracting, but then I do other things that are more akin to consulting. And, you know, my specialty with Rails consulting is more B2B. Like if you're making some flashy consumer app, I'm not your person. That's not my career has been B2B really. So, and I've found myself working with a lot of lovely folks who are uniformly grateful for your ability to you know, realize their vision. But are, in my experience, just sort of how I found things in the world is those folks are often not. They don't have a background in doing software development or building software companies. And as a person who's got, you know, several decades of experience at early stage companies and getting things started and getting prototypes turned into products and all that, I'll talk to people about coding. Like, yes, it should look like this. But I also do a lot of, I would say, coaching. Like lean methodology and like, hey, let's not build all of this. I know that you want to do all this, but let's build this really simple thing. Like I'm a big advocate for Bootstrap and no JavaScript. Like I'm all about like, hey, fast HTML is really great. And that's sort of a drum I've been banging for years now. And so like, so I do just hands-on coding, but I often am, like bringing that experience to the table, as well as like, I don't know, there have been some situations where I've essentially been like at larger companies, like coaching CTOs, like, hey, let's stop building features. Like we need to figure out why the thing you've got is not selling, or hey, what do you think? Like, what do you think the business is exactly that you're trying to satisfy with all these features? But in this fractional CTO work, like that's consulting. Like it is me bringing my experience, sort of, you know, venture guys always like to talk about their pattern matching. You know, so I bring my pattern matching and, you know, I have conversations with some people and some checklists and some frameworks. And it's like, hey, you know, here's a bunch of problems you're probably going to have. You know, you were talking just now about like, hey, I used to work by myself and now I work with this other person. And so a bunch of things happened that changed when I started working with this other person. It's like, yep, absolutely. And, you know, when you start working with three people, that's going to change again, and five and 10 and 20. And, you know, if you're bringing these people in at like an accelerated rate, like here's some other things that are going to go wrong. And, you know, honestly, a thing I do a lot of times is come to people and when they say like, oh, yeah, it's all terrible here, it's like, yeah, it's terrible everywhere. Like,
that's true.
Just what it looks like. And
yeah, it's true that it's terrible everywhere. And I'm always kind of amused a little bit when I talk with people who are really early in their careers and they get their first job and they complain about all these problems. They're like, man, this code base is terrible. There's like no comments in it. And I'm like, well, first of all, comments are actually not a good thing despite what you were taught in college.
Right.
But like the code base being poor quality, that's like, it would be a crazy, highly improbable miracle if you got a job somewhere and you look at the code base and you thought it was good. You know, like everybody's code base is terrible.
Well, it's, and the thing I always say to people, like you need to, like I try to keep people from using lazy language like it's terrible. It's like, well, what is, like, drill down into that a little bit, because terrible is not actionable. And then the other thing too is like, you know, hey, this quote unquote lousy code base just raised, you know, X million of dollars in venture funding and did like Y millions of dollars of revenue, which means it solved problems for like a ton of people. And like, you need to respect that.
Yeah, that's a good point about saying something's terrible is not specific and it's not actionable. And I've thought about that before myself. Like when we say a piece of code is bad, what exactly does that mean? To me, that means
messy.
That
messy is the word I hate. I hate messy codes. Like,
yeah.
Then run it through a code formatter. Now it's not messy anymore.
Right. Yeah. To me, the important thing of what you want in a code base is you want it to be easy to understand and easy to change. Because if it's easy to understand and change, then it's going to be less expensive and faster to work with, meaning you can do more stuff in less time and help the business. You can do more for the business in less time. And that's obviously the ultimate reason for having good or bad code. It's maybe having good code makes you feel good and stuff like that, which I think is genuinely important. But the business reason for having good code is that you can be more productive for the business. And so yeah. I've never encouraged a specific person, but when I shout into the ether, my hope is that I'm encouraging people not to advocate for quote unquote good code, because that's just as meaningless as saying bad code, but saying, rather than saying I need to clean up this code to make it higher quality or something like that, saying this code is hard to understand, it's going to take a really long time to change this code, unless I clean it up first, then it'll be really easy to work with and we can do more faster. I think that's a lot more compelling of a case.
Yeah, and you know, like context matters. So this is sort of a thing I say all the time these days. Is like, you know, a handful of years ago, I would be much more dogmatic about a lot of things, about, you know, how much test coverage you should have and whether you should do agile versus waterfall. And like it depends. It depends on what you're doing. And it's like, okay, this code is a mess. You know, or this code is problematic, or our static analysis tools tell us it's problematic and our intuition and our experience tells us. But it's like, we're also never in that file. Like, we never touch it. So in a world of finite resources and lots of priorities, you know, you just gotta let that go.
But, yeah, the analogy that I use with that is the analogy of dull and sharp saws. So like, if you have a garage full of saws and there's one saw that you use all the time, it makes a difference if that saw is sharp. And so if you go to use it and it's dull, it's worth sharpening because it's going to pay back. But if there's this saw that you haven't used it in a year, there's no point in going and sharpening that saw but if you pick it up and you need to use it, then maybe at that point in time it makes sense to sharpen it. That's why, as a side note, I used to be a believer in the idea that somebody could come in and review your code base and give you improvement suggestions. And now I wouldn't propose to do that myself, and I don't think it's a good idea for anybody to accept that as a service, because you really don't know what needs to be improved until you try to work with it. So you can't really analyze a code base statically without working with it. You have to like work with the team and see like, oh, this area changes like on a weekly basis. This area never changes. Okay, let's talk about this area that we change, and let's completely ignore this area that we never change, because that's not going to pay us back if we improve it.
Yeah, this is one of my I think you're not talking about like pull requests. You're talking sort of like globally inspecting a code base.
Right, like, hey, I'm some consultant, show me your code base, I'm going to go through it and give you suggestions.
Yeah, one of my favorite reports on some of the static analysis tools that are available is like this little 2x2, which shows you sort of how bad a file is versus how often it's touched, and you know, sort of flagging hotspots, and like that seems like a useful visualization that I think people should keep more front of mind about when they're thinking about, you know, these kinds of things. Like here's code we're in all the time that is very in a bad state, you know, given all these various like linting tools and whatever. I mean, the other thing too there is to keep in mind is maybe like how old is this code? Because maybe very new code that's in a bad, like this idea that you're gonna author this perfect code out off the top of your head seems hard. You know, it seems like code as you're figuring it out, especially if you haven't done like object analysis and you don't have a design, you're just kind of figuring it out. It's probably going to be messy before it gets better.
Oh, definitely. Yeah, it's pretty much inevitable that it's going to be suboptimal on the first swing.
Yeah, or even the subsequent swings. Like when you were talking about like, oh, hey, I worked on this new app and it was great and it was brand new. And, you know, I've done that a bunch in the past few years and it doesn't stay that way. You know, you kind of have this continual learning. And the code is often like these, a bunch of snapshots in time where they're a product of the reality they were at the time they were built, both your level and understanding. And I was one company I worked at, a place called the S-Ware, we had, we were scaling pretty fast in the sense of like the business usage was growing fast enough that we would kind of continually run into some new scaling issue. And so the code base was kind of like these snapshots of our sophistication of dealing with these issues, both kind of the level of usage we were seeing at the time the thing got implemented and our understanding of it. And so when you talk about code, it's like, it's just all different ages. It's from all different places. It's of all different needs. And so like, I think, you know, it's probably useful to think of it with some nuance like that. And especially if you're going to get like down about it and just, you know, so don't get down about it. You know, I said earlier about like, hey, that lousy code, you know, raised this money and made these customers happy. And it's like, this awesome, you know, I should actually rephrase that. Like, this awesome code made all these great things happen, you know? Hmm. And so, I don't know, like software engineers seem to be sort of a negative a lot sometimes. And like, maybe we should accentuate the positive and accept things on their terms, as opposed to like some platonic standard of like what good code is, because I don't know, man. Like,
I think that's true. I myself am certainly susceptible to having a negative outlook on quite a lot of things. And I try to pull myself back from that because that's not always productive. But yeah, there's a lot, going back to what you said earlier, there's a lot of stuff in my code base that represented maybe a good design decision at the time, and it was very fitting and appropriate at the time, but then reality changed, and the my code stayed the same. And so my code is no longer a good fit to the current reality. And so in order to keep my code understandable and easy to work with, it needed to change to update the new reality. And that usually takes the form of, you know, all this other code grew up around it. And so, wait, this thing no longer reconciles with this. And so we have to change it so they agree with one another and stuff like that.
Yeah. Yeah, I am. I love the word reality. I talk about this thing called the reality horizon, which is like a term in physics, but I've sort of repurposed it, which is like your reality has like a lifetime. And at different points, your reality, that lifetime may vary wildly. So for this earlier company that I was talking about, in one sense, our reality horizon was like 90 days because our doubling.
Sorry, I want to make sure I understand this term. Reality horizon, is that what you were explaining just now when you said that stuff? You're defining reality horizon?
Well, let me start again, because I just talked a lot. So reality horizon is sort of like how many days out your current reality is, your current understanding of reality is going to exist. So, for example, maybe you have perfect knowledge and the universe you live in is entirely static. So there, your reality horizon is probably infinite because like nothing's going to change. But if you're at a fast changing startup who's learning a lot, and so the thing we thought we understood yesterday, you know, we no longer know. It's like, if I make a decision today, in 45 days, will that decision still hold up? In 30 days, will that decision still hold up? And I think in a lot of situations, that time is a lot closer than we think. And so
like our reality horizon is shorter than we think.
Way shorter, yeah. So I mean, at a lot of startups that I'm at, I usually peg the reality horizon at like 45 days. Or maybe for some other things, like at this other company, the scaling issues, it's like I knew that our data doubled every 90 days. You know, the size of the data, like it doubled every 90 days. And so like, some decisions I make right now are probably not going to be as good in 90 days.
Yeah, that definitely seems true. Yeah, so reality is something I think about a lot because like there's reality and then there's our perception of reality and our model of reality. And like our perception of reality can never fully match reality because we just can't know everything. And so all we can have is like, well, we have this model of reality in our head. We're like, okay, there's the world, and here's my slice of the world that I care about, and I have these like useful approximations to the truth about everything so that I can function in day-to-day life. And the more faithful your model of reality is to actual reality, the more successful you will be in accomplishing whatever your goals are. And there's like, each individual person has their own model of reality. And then there's the communication aspect because you, Matt, have a model of reality which doesn't match actual reality. I have a model of reality which doesn't match actual reality. But then I can't even communicate my model of reality to you in a way that perfectly reflects the model that I have in my head and vice versa. And so there's all these different representations of reality. And it's a really hard thing to kind of get right.
Yeah, and I think, you know, the way I would summarize that maybe is like communication's really hard. Like it's really, really hard. And I think engineers actually may not to paint with too broad a brush and stereotype of people, but you know, I know a huge learning that I had, and maybe I still haven't completely learned it, is that you know, transmitting ideas between people is like the signal's lossy and it's can be a low power signal. And, you know, I remember young me, it's like, oh, I just have to write this perfectly crafted email and send it to you. And then I will change your mind. And, you know, especially, and by the way, that doesn't work. And, you know, once you start to do that with groups of people, you know, that gets a lot harder a lot quickly, you know, very quickly. And especially as the group gets larger, we've all seen the charts, like as an organization grows, sort of like how many communication paths there get put in place. And it's, you know, so it is a real challenge. And, you know, I think, you know, especially for software engineers, like it's not, we often don't even have a language for communicating these ideas. Like in a lot of ways, you know, we're scandalously undisciplined. Like it's code. At the end of the day, it's code. That's the language we have to describe things. And code's really hard to reason about. It's got like huge state space. And, you know, if you're like me, I can only like indent two levels of conditionals. I'm not one of these 14 levels of conditionals people who are brilliant, but not me. You know, it's really hard, you know, like things like UML, like I don't know UML. I can draw some boxes and arrows and do sudo, you know, UML. Not that I'm saying UMLs, but, you know, things like, I wonder sometimes if, you know, software engineers should make everybody learn the names of all the refactorings and refactoring, you know, the book Refactoring, or with the small talk patterns book, which I forget the exact name, although it's right behind me somewhere. You know, like there's a bunch of structures and constructs, you know, like caching variable or intention revealing method name, whatever. You know, you were talking about comments are not a thing you should write earlier. You know, it's like, I wonder if we would be served well by being more pedantic about insisting that we all knew that stuff.
Well, it is useful to have a common vocabulary. Like if I say to somebody, I think we could perform the extract method refactoring on this particular piece of code. It's helpful if I can just say that and we don't need to talk about it in terms of what that is and use way more words to describe the same idea.
Yeah. But I mean, just going back to, you know, you talking about modeling the world, it's like, we end up making these ad hoc languages on whiteboards and pieces of paper and, you know, I don't know, whatever slides or whatever, you know, we don't have a language, and it may be that language doesn't exist. Like I mentioned earlier, my electronic design automation background, which is writing software to build chips. And in the early days, that started off as, you know, drawing schematics. It started off as drawing tools where you have like a little picture of a chip or a gate, and then you would like literally draw the wires between these little bits. And that actually evolved into languages. Like languages is the they're higher level and lower level versions of this language, but, you know, languages that look not unlike C or Ruby in some ways. You know, there's a curly brace language, and then there's another more Pascal, like Ada like language called VHDL. And like that turns out to be the thing that's expressive enough to kind of describe these things. Although hardware engineers in general, I think, are more disciplined about development than software engineers, because for hardware engineers, the stakes are higher. It's harder to make mistakes. Mistakes are much more costly.
I can imagine the ways that's true. Yeah. There's an unrelated question that I want to ask, which goes back to earlier in our conversation about your consulting work. The question that I always ask people when I encounter a freelancer, consultant kind of person is, how do you find your clients? Because that's the key to everything. Because if you can get clients, then you're all set and kind of figure out everything else. But if you can't get clients, then you're screwed no matter what. And so how do you connect with these people?
Yeah, it's all fun and games until you have to start beating the bushes for work. I've been pretty lucky so far, and work has mostly just found me through my network. And, you know, I've only been doing this in earnest for a couple of years at this point. So, and people that I work with, I have worked with for a while. But it's mostly network. You know, I've suddenly, you know, have started to enjoy more kind of marketing and sales. You know, that's sort of why I reached out to you originally. And so, you know, I think for me, you know, I don't know exactly how you do it, but it doesn't happen for free. You know, it needs to be sales. It needs to be marketing. You need to be comfortable asking people for money and saying like, hey, I do that, and this is what that costs, and let me, you know, let me get a proposal to you, or, you know, this is what my rate is. And, you know, that's really uncomfortable for people. I think a lot of people, especially if you're go from being a salaried employee. So right now, you know, just mostly my network has been helpful to me, and people have reached out. They know I'm available. But it is a little terrifying. You know, I do not have a free minute between now and, like, I don't know, the end of October. But after that, I have no idea. So
I know the feeling.
So you know, but I've been saying that for the last year, even through, you know, when the pandemic, you know, came about, things got really rough, but then things just came roaring back. And
they really did.
Since August of 2020, I've just been pretty much flat out.
Yeah. The advice that I give people who are wanting to do freelancing and they want to know how to get clients, one thing that I say that's kind of tongue in cheek, but also not, is meet a bunch of people and wait 10 years. Which kind of sounds like the path you took. I'm reading between the lines a little bit, but it sounds like you have strong, trusting relationships that you've built up over a long period of time, and now you're kind of cashing in on the fact that you've built those relationships, and so those people have a reason to trust you and believe that you're going to be a valuable person to work with, and you're able to get clients that way. Is that kind of the right idea?
Oh my, you make me sound competent and awesome. Thank you. you know, I think it is what I've done. You know, I've never really thought of myself as like a networker or, but you know, I've met a bunch of people and I've worked with a bunch of people, and you know, I think I have built trust with people, and so yeah, my, you know, I do think that is paying dividends for me today. I don't expect that to pay dividends forever. You know, I've heard people say like, yeah, your network will silently feed you for a couple of years. And then you really need to start to work at it. And, you know, I can believe that that's true.
Yeah, that maybe seems about right. Another thing that I've said to people who are new to freelancing is like, well, if you want to get your first freelancing client, a good candidate is somebody you've worked for in the past. So you can go back to previous bosses you've had and stuff like that, and say, hey, I'm a freelancer now. I offer these services. Would you like to work together again? And I think often that works. That has worked for me, and I know other people who that's worked for too.
Yeah, absolutely. So I'm just running an inventory of current and recent clients, and people are either one degree of separation from that, or, you know, two at most, or is it zero? But it's all very closely related. You know, it's not like, actually, I'm probably like 2 degrees of separation out now, where a person has told a person who's gotten in touch with me. But it's not like a person has told a person has told a person. But, you know, my goal is to get there.
And I've found that some of the best ways to at least build credibility that will grease the wheels of any sales conversation that might happen is speaking and writing. And that's one reason why I originally started this podcast. And I found that when I do things, like I wrote this book about Angular years ago, and one particular conversation really struck me. I was having a conversation with a prospective freelancing client, and he basically said that he's like, obviously, you know what you're doing. You wrote this book. And I'm like, well, I think you're wrong about that, but feel free to believe that if you want to. But I didn't need to say anything to sell myself. You know, the work that I did spoke for itself. And so do you do anything like that? Obviously, you're on this podcast right now, which is one form of that, but do you do any writing or anything like that?
Yep. I have a blog, which I've started writing at a little bit. Have tried to carve out time for that more regularly with, you know, really mixed results, but haven't done that. Haven't really spoken at all. I haven't spoken anywhere probably in 10 years. That'd absolutely be something I'd be open to. I have done it. I enjoy it. I like talking to large groups of people. I like talking to people one-on-one. So I'm not exactly an extrovert. Like, small groups of people I don't know are problematic for me, but like, I'll get up in front of 1,000 people.
That's interesting you say that, because I'm the exact same way. I have the most trouble. So one-on-one is pretty easy for me, which I think is why this podcast works for me. I can have one-on-one conversations with people.
Yeah,
I can speak to a group of people of, I don't know what my limit is, but over 100 at least I'm comfortable with. Maybe a million people in a stadium would be just fine. I don't know. But put me in a group of like 5 people and I'm just like screwed.
Yeah, five people I might be okay with, but like your traditional networking event, I'm terrible at. I just don't know where to, how to crack that nut. But like one-on-one, I will meet anybody anywhere for like a 45-minute conversation on the phone or in person. And, you know, even if you're going to start to, something I tell people who want to start to get into like engineering management or some kind of leadership kind of roles where recruiting is often a big part. It's like, you need to go hold a 45-minute conversation with a stranger on zero notice, no problem, in pretty much any venue, any kind of medium, because that's just kind of a thing you got to do.
So there's a lot more questions I want to ask you, but we only have time for not a lot of more questions, unfortunately. But here's something I need to ask you about, because I see all these books behind you. I can only read the title of one book and it says calculus, but I'm curious what some of these other books are that you have behind you, and just books in general. What kind of stuff do you like to read? And are there any books in particular? Oh, and I think I saw The Goal, when you just turned just now. Is that what I saw?
Yeah, you did.
Yeah, I couldn't read it, but I recognized the design. Yeah. What kind of stuff do you like to read?
These days, I'm sorry to say that I read a lot of self-published trashy fiction on Kindle, which is terrible. But mostly what I read about is, a lot of kind of just business stuff. So I think, people management kind of books and, product development books, like Lean Product Development Flow by Dan Reinertsen. I always mispronounce his name, is like a book I think about a lot. And then, you know, I think there are a handful of coding books. You know, I mentioned a couple of them, like Refactoring and the Small Talk Patterns book. I know the Gang of Four book is kind of in disrepute for some reason, but I think that's, I don't know. I hear people always talk about it in a kind of pejorative sort of way.
Interesting. I have not come across that. I've heard people saying bad things about Clean Code by Robert Martin, but I think that's kind of a reverse halo effect rather than the actual content of the book.
I think it's there. I haven't read it in a while, but I get a bunch of O'Reilly books up there. Like back in the day, having a bookshelf full of O'Reilly books at work was a thing. I have my C programming book up there, so the other language that I love is just C, which is where I did a lot, you know, probably the first 5 or 10 years of my coding before sort of serendipitously learning about Ruby and Rails, which is sort of my favorite language by a lot.
Yeah, me too. You know, languages come up on this show sometimes, and it's not surprising at all that most guests on this podcast, which historically has been a Ruby on Rails podcast, just recently changed to a global coding podcast. But most of the guests express Ruby as their favorite language, and me too, for sure. There's some others that I've worked with that I've worked with Lisp a little bit. That's actually what drew me to Ruby. Is back when I first tried Lisp, nobody was really using Lisp to do anything real with web development. So I'm like, okay, what's the closest thing at least?
Yeah. I've made a couple of goes at Lisp and it just hasn't, you know, it hasn't taken. I've tried Elixir a couple times and that really didn't take. I keep trying to figure out how I can gather some data for this, but I feel anecdotally that we're in a Rails and Ruby renaissance. Like I see, a bunch of people are coming back. I think a bunch of people, or if people aren't coming back, the migration out to other languages. Like I think there was this period where people were moving out to Go, people were moving out to Elixir. I think people were moving out to Node JavaScript, obviously, but like in at Rails Gigs, you know, this job website that I run, you see a ton of jobs that are Rails and some other stuff. And my reading of them is not that we're moving to those other things, but we have this big Rails thing, and then we tried some other stuff, but the Rails gravity keeps pulling us back. And this is kind of consistent with my experience, where there have been large Rails monoliths and a bunch of services that got stood up, but man, that monolith like never goes away. And then I think once you start finding yourself in an extremely heterogeneous environment with languages, I know that especially as a leader, I just dislike that. Just because now I've got a bunch of different stacks and a bunch of libraries, and you know, sort of my level of expertise per language has been highly diluted because, yeah, okay, these two people know Go, but how well do they know Go? We have like no Go expert. And if those two people go on vacation at the same time and whatever service they stood up goes down, we're all going to have a bad day.
Yeah, so that's a rough situation. Yeah, I feel kind of anecdotally the same way. It's clearly really hard to hire Rails developers right now. So I'll say some things that I don't necessarily believe are necessarily true, but they seem maybe true. Like
assertions.
Yeah. Everybody wants to hire Rails developers now, and nobody can find anybody. That's what seems to be the case right now.
Especially senior devs, yes.
Yeah. Yeah, and what's unfortunate for people who are seeking opportunities, it's like you can't just go and become a senior Rails developer in order to capitalize on this time of opportunity. You have to have been a Rails developer for a long time in order to be that person. And the other thing that's a little bit unfortunate is you can only have one job at a time. And so we're in this time of great opportunity if you're a senior Rails developer, but you can only exploit that opportunity so much. I guess the best you can do is get a pretty good salary right now if you're trying to get a new job or something like that. But yeah, it's really, the market is really heavy in the demand and low in the supply right now.
I would concur with that. Yeah, I think the pandemic hit junior devs harder than it hit senior devs. So I have multiple anecdata that, you know, when people were shedding staff, they shed, you know, juniors faster than seniors. Those folks got, had slower uptick. And I know that on I've actually got a draft blog post about this that I should publish, that on the Rails Gig site, that the number of searches for junior is only beat by the search for remote. So, there are far fewer junior jobs than other level jobs, and there are more people looking for them. And, you know, if you look at like Reddit and a hangout at the RailsLink Slack where, you and I got in contact, there's a lot more conversation about finding junior jobs and other kind of chat places I hang out. People talking about like, I'm a junior. How do I find a job? How do I find a job? And, you know, it's tough. I mean, if you're at a company and you are in like an uncertain time where you don't know how you all are going to do, signing up to bring on a person that you're going to have to invest in heavily, and like depending where that person came from, let's talk about Code Academy or other bootcamp people. You know, occasionally you find a person who just takes off from there, but my experience is you're often gearing up to make you know, a year plus investment in that person.
Yeah, that definitely seems true. Yeah, and I want to ask you, this will probably be the last topic that I ask you about before we wrap up, but I do want to give us a chance to talk about Rails Gigs. When did you start that? Why did you want to start that? You know, the world already has job boards. What made you want to start a job board of your own?
Yeah, that's a great question. So it started sort of, I started it originally over a year ago. Got really busy, as I talked about, August 2020, and sort of like shelved it. But then we relaunched it in this last winter. I launched it for a bunch of reasons. Like, I really love Ruby and Rails. Like, it has given me a fantastic career over the past, you know, last half or so of my career. I want to do things to support the Rails environment. So if you can make the labor market liquid and help you know, surface where folks can find jobs, that was interesting to me. It gave me an excuse to write a Rails app, which was interesting to me. Hiring and recruiting are really sort of a subspecialty of mine, both in my consulting work and this. Like, I really, I have had to hire a bunch of people a bunch of times, and I just want better ways to do it. And I know that there are, you know, there are now actually a couple Ruby Rails jobs boards in flight. You know, I've got ideas. You know, it's not a fully fledged idea. It's a thing I built and launched. But like, I just want to help people find the people that they're trying to hire. It's just a general, it's just got adjacency to an area that I'm interested in. Like, so when I'm growing teams, like, I take a lot of care in kind of hiring process and how you do that at scale efficiently. And so, like, these are just all things that are kind of part of my interests. And it's a thing I can start. You know, it's not venture scale. It's a non-venture scale project, as I call them. And that's, you know, that's why I did it.
Mm-hmm. And how did you get people to actually use it, especially with the classic marketplace challenge where you need people on both sides? You need the job seekers there and you need the job posters there. How did you deal with all that?
Yeah, so it's tough and it's an ongoing process. You know, things are up and to the right. You'd like them to go up and to the right faster, but so we seed a bunch of jobs on the site. People also, currently the way job postings are free, we do some monetization through featured placement right now. So that's the model. I'm sure that will get tweaked with a ton. So basically, there are a couple spots on the site where you kind of just sort of exclusively can have your job posting featured. And like, depending on what it is, it costs a different amount of money. Right now, I'm not trying to have it generate a ton of cash. You know, it just takes time to build up traffic to the site and to build up backlinks and all that stuff. And job sites are kind of uniquely ill-suited for generating that kind of thing. You know, like, a lot of classic SEO tactics don't seem to work particularly well for it. You know, but I'm doing some blogging. Like, I've done some blogging, trying to do some minimal spend on actual advertising, but don't really have a lot of stomach for that and don't want to have to monitor that pretty actively. So that's anyway, that's why I did it, and that's kind of how it's going.
And just one more little side question. Was railsgigs.com easy to get? That seems like a pretty good domain name that maybe you weren't the first person to have the idea to buy it. So was that easy to get?
That was easy to get, as it was unregistered at the time. There are some other domains I would have rather had, but could not get in contact with the people. I think somebody actually had Rails Gigs registered 15 years ago or something like that, or 10 years ago. There are some, you know, there are some artifacts on the internet that give just the slightest, sort of like the background radiation of the universe, that had happened. I'm sure somebody who's more hip to historical domain registration could point to some authoritative source, but no, it was easy to get. And it's a pretty good name.
Yeah, I think it's a good name. It has a ring to it. It sounds like... It does not sound like a kind of thing you made because you couldn't get the domain name that was your first choice.
Well, it's another kind thing you said today. Thank you.
I'm glad you take it that way because it sounds like a very not the greatest compliment in the world, but I do mean it positively, of course. Yeah, I looked into getting jason.com recently because there was this...
Oh, yeah.
I wanted to have somebody on the podcast and her domain was gale.com. And I'm like, wow, gale.com. Wow. I wonder about who has jason.com. Turns out nobody has jason.com. And so I looked into it and I don't remember if I had an actual email exchange or something, but the price was like in the hundreds of thousands of dollars or something like that.
I'm unsurprised. Unsurprised to hear that.
Yeah, I talked to a guy once at a conference. He had this business that its domain was HIPAA.com, like H-I-P-A-A. And his business got bought for like $500,000. And he said they just shut down the business because all they wanted was the domain and they paid $500,000 for that.
I absolutely believe that.
Yeah. Yeah, it's crazy. I now am familiar with like the prices of domains, but I was surprised when I first heard that, but those things can go for some serious money because apparently it makes a real business impact. Doesn't always seem like it would, but apparently it does.
Oh no, there's are you familiar with I think it's Peter Eskew, the Vidalia Onions guy?
Oh no.
Also known as Searchbound on Twitter. He's like all about domains and has sort of over the past year or so, he's sort of a domains and job boards guy. And has really got pretty strong thoughts about the power of good domains.
I'll have to check him out. Okay, so we covered a lot of good topics today. I really enjoyed this conversation. Very last question for you. Where can people go? Obviously railsgigs.com. Anything else you want to share with people, or is that where you want people to go?
I want people to go there if they are looking to find a job programming Rails or they need to fill one. But I am also MJ Bellantoni, MJBellantoni on Twitter. And I am MatthewBellantoni.com. You can find my blog there and links to all the other stuff there.
And we'll, of course, put all that stuff in the show notes. Matthew, thanks so much for coming on the show.
It was a pleasure, Jason. Thank you.